Welcome to Beer Stories for Private Equity. Join us for our weekly happy hour, tapping into 27 years of PE experience, one pint at a time.
Beer Stories for Private Equity is powered by Monogram Group.
On today's show, we're excited to be joined by Jared Turner, the founder and managing partner of Soundcore Capital Partners in New York.
And for Monogram Group, here's your host, Scott Markman.
Please fasten your seatbelts.
Jared Turner from Soundcore Capital Partners, welcome to the podcast. Really great to have you as a guest.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Excellent. So let's get into it. You get your undergraduate degree at Colgate, then you work for a couple of great firms prior to founding Soundcore. So how does a poli-sci major get into private equity in the first place?
Yeah, I would say that having a private equity skill set that's pretty standard in this industry is being able to express yourself, good written skills, ability to multitask. A lot of that comes from a sound and well-rounded liberal arts background. I found that a lot of people coming out of Colgate would be able to go into investment banking, private equity, and do quite well without an acute skill set until they got onto the job, learned it in the summers, and then actually did better than some people coming out of standardized business school programs from undergrad.
Okay. I mean, that's an interesting take. I mean, critical thinking, good writing, researchability, that stuff. So like advanced math was not like a requirement to succeed in this business, right?
Yeah. One of the things that I reflect on in private equities, you're using maybe up to fifth grade math. You really didn't have to go further in school than like 12-year-old to be in private equity.
All right. So my takeaway from the first thing I heard from Jared is there's hope for me yet at 64 that my command of fifth grade math would serve me well if I pivot into private equity. All right. Let's fast forward to those first couple of jobs. Tell us about those and getting your feet wet and a sense of, is this what I want to dedicate my career to? And the answer was yes. So what happened in a good way that led you to decide to pursue this even more deeply?
Sure. I started my career in investment banking, which in investment banking, you're on the sell side, really with no upper opportunity to continue to make money. Private equity, you have unlimited upside. Lending, you have capped upside, and you have downside risk. And so when I started my career, I started off in investment banking. I segued that into a mezzanine fund that had some equity upside, but had capped upside on the lending side. And as I thought about what I was doing for a living, I ultimately decided that I wanted to be on the pure play private equity side.
Okay. No, I love the clarity of your laying out the rationale. It's a very almost a clinical approach. And again, there's no right or wrong to any of this stuff. There are lots of folks who we both know that went into debt and have had spectacular rewarding careers. And it's just that you pursued things that excited you and were matched with what you were trying to accomplish, right?
I'd also add where you fit in the capital structure in private equity, you're below the debt. So it really takes people with more entrepreneurial natures and risk-taking than people that are on the debt side.
Okay, so we're going to come back to that because that's probably going to be a little bit of a narrative that is going to dovetail with some of the questions we're going to get into in just a minute. So you have some great experiences and at some point, let's say in your early-ish 30s, as I recall, you come to the dark side of entrepreneurship and say, I'm going to hang my shingle and create my own firm and a fund. So you've decided to pursue that, what, 7 to 10 years before your peers? So what led to that?
I think I come from an entrepreneurial background. Both my grandfathers and my father, all three of them individually started their own separate businesses, all in different disciplines. So maybe it's in my DNA. And I decided when I was 30 years old that I wanted to launch my own firm. I wasn't ready to do that until I was 33. I had thought very linearly about how much savings I had. I had about 3 years of savings in order to sustain myself in New York City. And I was willing to risk it all in order to launch a best-in-class lower middle market private equity firm that would stand the test of time. And I believe the strategy that I had formulated was differentiated and was going to be enduring, something that would do well in any part of the economy. And so I was ready to launch it, and I officially did in March of 2015.
All right. So you decide to do this, and you pick the name Soundcore. And I know from our past discussions that there's a lot of thinking that went into that. So Just share that with our listeners. Why the name Soncor? What does it mean to you?
Sure. Taking a step back, when thinking about naming your company or your firm, you could have a name that gives a description of what you're going to do. It's easier, I would say, in certain businesses, maybe a plumbing business or a roofing business, the type of things that we would go into as investments. It's difficult to come up with that exact name for a private equity firm. A lot of people use mountains or they use Greek mythology. You know, for me, ultimately, I wanted something that meant something to me personally. So the name Soncor is derived from sound investments and core investing principles. The sound investments part of it is buying companies that do well no matter what's happening in the economy. I've really firmed that up as critical services. And the core principles are having the highest ethics, the highest morals, your fiduciary duty comes before everything else, and also being very repeatable in your processes and in your principles of doing things in a repeatable nature so that the private equity effort will stand the test of time.
Awesome. Before we go any further, I do want to introduce something near and dear to me. It's called New Glarus Brewing Company. It is from New Glarus, Wisconsin, and they are known in the Midwest as being the liquid of the gods in Wisconsin. You cannot buy this once you cross the state line into Illinois. I'm going to tip my hat to our good friends at New Glarus. Spotted Cow is the brand, and here we go. It is Friday. I'm drinking beer. All is good.
It would be true Wisconsin of you to have that with cheese, Scott.
No, cheese curds. You want to get really cheeseheady, let's go. All right, I digress. So let's talk about expanding upon these foundational principles and higher wisdom that led to naming and the way you do things and why. So let's talk about how your firm does what it does, the processes you go through that lead to the deals that you create. Because again, I know this is different than many of our other clients.
Yeah, I think if you look at private equity across the spectrum, 90 to 99% of private equity firms are reacting to companies that are for sale. They're reacting to an opportunity where they ultimately have to price something against 100 to 200 other firms or at least 10 other firms in a limited auction process. Take Soncor, we're left a stage of that, and we are a proactive, thesis-driven think tank private equity firm. And in doing that, if you are a thesis-driven private equity firm, you're able to develop a concept, a hypothesis of something that you want to go after that isn't necessarily for sale. And so that's a huge differentiation versus the rest of private equity that's waiting for something to land on their doorstep and then price that. And then by definition, if they're winning that asset, they're paying the highest price, reducing profitability or reducing upside for their profit dollars. When you think about Soncor, when we're thinking about going into an industry, we have to juxtapose the idea, the hypothesis, the fresh idea that we brought to the table to our investment mandate, which all the way down to the bottom of the system is consistent free cash flow. Companies that did well during the great financial crisis, companies that did well during COVID. Ultimately, when we bring those ideas to the table, we have a systematic way of validating those ideas because you can believe certain characteristics are true, but you don't know they're true without assembling data that either supports it or kills that thesis. And what we do from there, if we deem it via consensus in our fresh ideas sessions, which we have every single Monday, we will ultimately spend a few weeks to a few months making 2,000 plus telephone calls directly to business owners to validate a thesis and qualify the idea. And then we have a systematic 14-page deck that we have to fill out once we have the necessary information and then bring that back to the investment committee in order to get approval to spend dollars to get on the road, to advertise in national trade magazines, to go to industry conferences, to go out and meet with these business owners and solicit them for more information, potentially go under letter of intent. So it's a very different process than other private equity firms.
So when you think about the currency of time and money, right, the people, the calendar weeks and months that it takes to do what you just said, this is a huge investment and a big risk. compared to how other firms do it, where books come in, you do your due diligence, you crunch your numbers, you do the homework on the category, and if it all checks out, then you're going to put an IOI together and pursue, and you can be doing multiple of these. You're putting a lot more resources against fewer ideas to end up with the same result as others, but it's a wildly different path, correct?
It's a wildly different path. Soundcore doesn't put IOIs together, but we put LOIs together. We submit those LOIs directly to business owners. And directionally, we've now acquired 90 companies. 86 of those 90 companies were the first institutional capital. That's 96% of the time were the first outside dollars that are coming into a founder or family-owned business. When we think about doing that, we're building this trust directly with the business owner, but it's a very efficient process ultimately. Could take some time versus if you are a private equity firm responding to an opportunity. If you're one of 100 buyers or one or 200 buyers, a lot of private equity's time is wasted time. Most associates through VPs at private equity firms are lucky to complete a deal every couple of years because they're chasing these auction processes on a percent basis. It's less than a 1% chance you're going to win. And so in our case, the things that we go after and spend a lot of time on, it's our decision or whether or not we buy the company. So we're much more efficient with our time.
By the very nature of the structure, are you buying smaller platform companies than others?
We are. So we've now, as I mentioned, acquired 90 companies. Of those 90 companies, 75 of them are below 5 million of EBITDA. So we're buying in the lower end of the lower middle market. And there's a lot of inefficiency and a lot of value creation to be had because they're too small for brokers to firmly cover. And certainly they're too small for bankers to make a big enough fee that it's not really worth their time. A lot of times bankers will introduce you to those companies for free in the sense that if they do that, then you'll be reminded of them when you ultimately want to sell down the road off of 30 or 40 million of EBITDA. You might sell through that banker that gave you a tip on a small business that's made $4 or $5 million of EBITDA. But the one thing to note, in the United States, there's still over 250,000 companies that are privately owned that have at least $10 million of revenue. There's hundreds of thousands more that are these $1 to $2 million EBITDA businesses that are quiet, family-owned, founder-owned businesses. And that's really the Soundcore sweet spot.
Okay. So you have identified a unique philosophy strategy. You have identified a unique process. You've identified characteristics and I'll call it scale of companies that fit your sweet spot. So then what? So you decide to pursue the thesis. You buy that first foundational platform company. Then what? How do you pursue the bolt-ons and the integration and all of it? Is it harder, the same as how other firms do what they do?
That's a really great question, Scott. So another key difference between Soundcore strategy and other private equity firms that pursue buy and builds or a platform plus add-ons or tuck-ins or whatever they'll call them is that by definition, everything that Soundcore buys is an add-on. There is no platform acquisition. The way I would even frame it up as a bumper sticker is Soundcore creates platforms. We don't start with a platform. We start with a thesis. Okay. And so rather than buying one $30 million EBITDA business for 10 to 15 times, like the vast majority of private equity firms today, we would rather buy 10 $3 million EBITDA businesses that are all $3 million of EBITDA with no natural platform. And then we would keep those business owners in place. We would cash them out 80 or 90% of their ownership. And then we bring in a national CEO to sit on top of them. And we call that the platform leadership team. And then around that CEO we bring in, we ultimately bring in a national CFO, a national COO, a head of HR, head of safety, head of training, general counsel, and our own M&A team directly into that holdco so that we, Soundcore, are not having to do the heavy lift on every additional add-on acquisition.
So, okay, now, what's another thing that I just heard is that oftentimes this question, and I'll call it the standard way of doing things, is a platform company X is bought and does the founder stay with the company and continue in that role? And a lot of times it happens, other times it doesn't. you're saying structurally and philosophically, that's not in play because your model is you're going to find a national guy.
I think it's a big distinction. It's something that you have to ascertain over time. But generally speaking, someone that today is running a $3 to $5 million EBITDA business in a local state, or maybe it's in two states, they generally don't have the skill set within 2 years to be running a $50 to $100 million EBITDA business for an upscale private equity firm that we ultimately want to sell to. And if you don't have that platform leadership in place and you've got a bunch of disparate assets that haven't been properly integrated with leadership in place, all on the same ERP system, and now I'm getting more into integration, you will not get a platform multiple from the buyer set. You also will get dinged if you exit without a true platform leader, someone that has run something for a Warburg Pincus or a KKR or a Blackstone. We Soundcore identified that weakness in the lower middle market, and we specifically targeted bringing in that type of leadership talent early on, typically in the first year and a half, as we assembled, you know, individual add-ons that we're assembling into a platform.
Is there one of your portfolio companies, maybe one that you've exited, that you can map onto what you just said?
Yeah, one example is a business that we created called Pumpman. We started off in September of 2016. It was the second platform creation in Soundcore history. We brought in the former CEO of American Standard, so a bulge bracket CEO. We identified him as the talented person that could do this buy and build with us. He co-underwrote the thesis with us. We knew that we wanted to be in major cities throughout the United States because what this company does is it fixes and repairs pump systems, typically in large commercial buildings that have booster pumps that push water pressure up and take waste out of the building. And so population density matters because you have more tall buildings in those centers. Ultimately, we found there were thousands of acquisition targets throughout the country. And over a series of years, we made 14 strategic acquisitions. We became a national company. We had some semi-regional, some national accounts. We weren't in every city, but that was by design. We left a lot of meat on the bone for the next buyer. We ultimately hired an investment bank after a thoughtful bank process. And we sold the business last December to an affiliate of Bain Capital, a large-scale private equity firm, one of the bulge bracket ones that I would say has been around since the early innings of private equity. And the other finalists for that were all private equity firms that have been around since the 1970s, 1980s, that identified this was a need to have business. They were willing to pay a quality multiple to clear an auction process. And they had a thesis to further develop off of what we had built out as a private equity firm. We had integrated these businesses. We put them all on the same ERP system. We were able to capture daily KPIs from them so we could make key decisions at the corporate level. We were able to flow that into weekly flash reports, up to monthly update reports, up to quarterly board meetings, and then into annual operating plans so that we could make strategic decisions at both at the board level and at the management level.
Now, it sounds like there was a hold of 7 years, right?
Approximately, yes. Yep.
So is that average, a long time? It's a little on the longer edge of whatever I hear is that 3 to 7 year window, right?
Sure. For us, we've sold businesses in less than 3 years, and we've sold businesses, in the case of Pumpman, in 7 years. I would still say if you did our mathematical median hold period, probably be about 4 years, which is directionally where we want to be. There was an opportunity for us to continue to do add-ons for Pumpman. It took a little bit longer than we had underwritten initially, but we got to where we wanted to be. We saw that it was a strong market for assets like Pumpman, and we decided it was the right time to exit the business. We were up at our limit in terms of the capital we could deploy.
I noticed a couple of weeks ago that you authored a very long and pointedly worded essay on LinkedIn about the state of private equity and leading to upcoming trends and your point of view of the state of the industry. Could you share the highlights of that with our listeners?
Yeah, I think the article that you're referring to is something that I responded to that I thought was important for people to think about. And it was an opportunity for me to, again, juxtapose Soundcore versus a lot of the market. I think my main thesis contention is that private equity is at a maturation point as a whole. Many firms are on their fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, 10th vintages now. Some firms that have been around since the 1970s have whole new managing partners through the system, and a lot of the founders have passed away. And private equity is looking, you know, to become more an asset manager. There's private equity firms that are now raising real estate funds and debt funds and going into lateral strategies to grow their AUM. And that's fine. But as I talked about the greatest cohort of private equity, that is something that I mentioned earlier that are competing in these broad auction processes. And you'll see the same 200 to 300 US private equity firms competing largely in the exact same processes from the top 20 investment banks time and time again. And so they're not offering their investors anything different. I personally think you'd be better off if you invested in one of those funds, investing in a fund of fund where you get exposure to all 300 of them across a broad section of fund of funds or a fund of fund. What those firms have been incentivized to do, though, over the last 4 years was to raise as big a fund as their investors would bear. It benefited the GP and not the LP. They are driving towards greater fund sizes where they're generating more management fees that benefit their subset of employees, which ultimately heavily weights towards the managing partners of the firm, doesn't benefit the LPs. They're not hiring a linear basis or linear level of employees to the firm. So there's an outsized number of cash dollars that are coming out to the people that hold the greatest ownership percentage of the management company. And those firms are driving to lower MOICs because as they have more capital, they're competing in even more competitive auction processes. So again, it's not a benefit to their investors. And because they overpaid for businesses, while the music was playing, I largely capped my argument between 2017 to 2022, and there was essentially free debt during that period. As soon as debt ramped up 550 basis points and leverage came down from lenders, ultimately what that meant was private equity firms that overpaid for businesses by two or three turns were stuck because they can't today sell the company that they bought in 2021 or 2019 for anywhere close to what they paid for at that point in time. And so they're left with a difficult decision either to do a single asset continuation vehicle, a multi-asset continuation vehicle, or hold the business longer, get a fund extension, or sell that at a loss right now. The options for most firms that overpaid for businesses. And those firms don't want to talk about it because they don't really want to have that difficult realization and they don't want to tell that to their LPs. What I was trying to do in terms of juxtaposing Soundcore, though, is that we sold two businesses out of our fund two last year, which was a $350 million vehicle we raised in 2018. Because we never overpaid for any business, we were able to exit businesses in 2023 that generated 105% of the fund, which is top decile DPI according to PitchBook, and only selling two of the six companies, so a third of the portfolio. Even though we didn't sell them for max multiples, we still generated top MOICs and top level DPI because we were able to exit, because we still created arbitrage by buying right in the first place.
Thank you so much. One last thing, I want to offer you the opportunity to mention something or add something that you thought about when we were talking that you didn't say.
Sure. I think one of the most important things as you are buying family businesses is to continue to incentivize those family business owners, their employees. I think it's really important as a private equity firm, and one of the lessons I learned from other firms that I worked at is the associates of those private equity firms did not receive carry. A lot of times the owners of private equity firms are worried that there's a lot of turnover at the associate level and it's complicated to give them carried interest. And there's a lot of legal work and costs associated with it. And it's a big headache. But here at Soundcore, since the very beginning of the firm, every single employee, including our office manager, has carried interest that vest evenly over 5 years. We're all rowing in the same direction that way. That's something I'm really proud of.
All right, dude, this was awesome. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, I think what you're doing here is really cool. And I feel honored that you included me, Scott.
From all of us at Monogram Group, thanks for tuning in to Beer Stories for Private Equity.
Episode 11.
Don't forget to hit the subscribe button and you'll be notified as we release new episodes. Please check out the show notes in the description from today's episode. Our email is podcast@monogramgroup.com. Feel free to email us with any comments or questions, and we'll try to answer them in our next episode.